shoes. But every time I killed an alligator, it wasn't wearing any shoes. Alligators are about the only game we haven't hunted, unless we had to. We never had much money growing up, but Daddy always made sure we had ammunition and guns for hunting because we wouldn't have much meat to eat if we didn't kill game. There were two guns in our house for us to use. Daddy's Browning semi-automatic 16-gauge shotgun and a Remington 22 that belonged to our Uncle Al Robertson, which somehow wound up in our house. It was a bolt action with a 7-shot clip. During duck season, we always managed to find a second shotgun to use. When duck season opened my 6th grade year, Daddy went out and bought us a couple of boxes of shotgun shells like he did at the start of every season. Phil was in the 8th grade and was 14 years old. On opening day, we jumped in the Ford Falcon and Phil drove us, without a driver's license, to the duck hole, which was about 15 miles from our house at Horseshoe Lake in Gilliam, Louisiana. Horseshoe Lake was one of our favorite holes to hunt mallard ducks. There were a bunch of willow trees growing at one end of the lake, and when the water level was high enough, mallard ducks sat in the hole. Phil knew the river was high, so it was time to go shoot mallard ducks. "Let's go whack 'em," Phil said. While we always had shotgun shells and guns to use, we were too poor to buy waders, which keep you dry when you're walking through the swamp to get to the duck hole. Blue jeans and tennis shoes were our waders. That's what we wore to wade through chilly water, regardless of what time of year it was. Hey, what do you get when you throw blue jeans and tennis shoes into a lake? A wetsuit, Jack, and it made for some long days in the water. When we arrived at Horseshoe Lake, we started to wade through the swamp. The water was about waist deep, and it was early January, so the water was probably only 20 degrees. It was cold. After a few steps, Phil noticed a log sitting to the left of us. "Hey, watch out," he told me. "Don't trip over that log." I walked past the log and didn't think much of it. After we found a spot in the duck hole that would conceal us, this was long before we started building duck blinds, we stood shaking in the water and waiting for the ducks. Fortunately, we had to wait only a few minutes before a flock of mallards came into sight. Phil called them over and they sailed right over us. Boom, 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 boom. We knocked down 4 mallard ducks, 2 apiece, on the first pass. Being the youngest brother, I waded through the ice-cold water and retrieved our kill. On my way back to the blind, Phil reminded me not to trip over the log. "Hey, watch it," Phil said. "There's that log again." "I see it," I said. "I'm not blind." After a few more minutes, another bunch of mallards came into view. We both had guns, so we had 3 shots apiece. Phil called the ducks. He was really good at doing it, even when he was young. And they flew right over our blind again. We each brought down 3 more ducks. "Hey, there's a cripple over there," Phil said. "Shoot it again." I looked to my left, and there was a big mallard drake floating in the water by the log. He was still moving. I was closest to the wounded duck, so I aimed to shoot him again. But then I saw that the duck was face down in the water, so I figured he was close to dying, so I wasn't going to waste another shell on him. "Shoot him," Phil yelled. "Hey, he's dead," I said. "No, he's not," Phil said. "Shoot him again." "Hey, trust me, he's deader than a lobster in butter sauce," I said. "I'm 5 feet from him. He's not going anywhere." That duck was spinning in the lake like water does when you're draining a bathtub. All of a sudden, the duck started spinning faster and faster. And then the big mallard drake was gone. It popped under the water like a cork does when you hook a 2-pound crappie. Then that 20-foot log started moving. It sucked the mallard drake about 2 feet under the water. I looked at Phil and said, "Whoa, that log is an alligator." We'd been walking around that stupid thing for 30 minutes. Hey, newsflash, we didn't walk on water that day, but we got out of it. See you later, alligator.
I'm the master of distractions. A couple of hand gestures and bam, I'll pull the underwear clean off your butt.
Chapter 8. Dancing with Wolves. You've got to understand one thing about me. I had 4 older brothers and 1 older sister. I was the baby boy of the Robertson family. All of my life, wherever I went, people were always comparing me to my older siblings. If I did something wrong in school, one of the teachers would undoubtedly say, "Well, good grief, Harold wouldn't have done that." If I did something foolish at church, my Sunday school teacher might say, "Well, goodness, Si, Judy wouldn't have done that." Hey, newsflash, I'm not Harold and I'm not Judy. I'm Silas Merritt Robertson. Growing up, I had an identity crisis because I was always being compared to someone else. All of my life, all I ever heard was, "You're not doing it like so-and-so used to do it." Hey, guess what? I'm not so-and-so, I'm me. My older brothers are the reason I'm afraid of the dark and still have separation anxiety to this day. We'd go into the woods to hunt or play hide-and-seek, and they'd run back to our house without telling me. They'd leave me in the woods alone, and they especially liked to pull the trick when it was dark. I would cry, "Hey, where did y'all go? Hey, come back, please come back," but even when it was light outside, I didn't like to be left alone. Hey, would you want to be left alone with the thoughts being pondered in this head? My mind, it's wide open. It's like a hollow tunnel of air. When Phil was in high school, he came home one Friday and said he and a couple of his football teammates were going camping on the Red River. They were going to go fishing the entire weekend and wouldn't be home until Sunday. Of course, the first thing out of Mama's mouth was, "Take your younger brother with you." Andy Yarbrough and another football player came by our house to pick up Phil and me, and they made me ride in the back while the three of them planned our trip in the cab. They decided I was going to drive our boat across the Red River to a camping site on the other side and wait for them to get there. We pulled up to the Red River and put our boat in the water, and then they showed me how to crank the motor. "You see that big log on the riverbank over there?" Phil asked me. "Drive the boat over there, tie it up good, and don't let it get away. We're going to drive the truck the long way, go across the bridge, and come in the back way to the woods. When you get to the other side, you'll see a trail. Follow it up the hill, and you'll find the campsite. We'll see you in a little while." "How long before you get there?" I asked him. "We'll get there before dark," Phil said. I told him as long as they were there before dark, I'd do it. I was in the 9th grade and was still afraid of the dark. They left in the truck, and I motored the boat across the river just as the sun was starting to set. I parked the boat, tied it down, and then walked down the trail Phil told me about. I walked into the woods and quickly realized there wasn't a house or another human being within 40 miles of me. I was in the wilderness. I had no idea where I was, but I somehow found the campsite, which was about a 15-foot circle slab in the very middle of the woods. I sat down and waited for Phil and his buddies to get there. After about 20 minutes, I noticed the sun was going down over the horizon. It was barely visible. Darkness was coming, and it was coming quickly. I was getting more nervous with every passing second. Suddenly, I heard a ruckus behind me. It was a pack of wild wolves. Along with being terrified of the dark, I was also afraid of wolves. They were actually coyotes, but we called them wolves. When you have wild dogs that are capable of dragging down large cattle and killing full-grown bulls, they are wolves. I was trying to keep my composure, but the sounds of the wolves were getting closer and closer. I stood up and looked behind me, and I saw one of the wolves poke his head out of the brush. It was looking right at me. I looked to my right and saw tire tracks going up the other side of the woods. As I pondered what to do, I saw another wolf stick his head out of the brush, and then another one. I knew I was in trouble, so I took off running down the barely visible road. Hey, Fred Astaire's got nothing on me, but I wasn't about to be dancing with wolves. After I took off running, the wolves jumped in behind me and were yelping. They were getting louder and louder. I knew there were a bunch of them behind me, but I was too afraid to look back. I felt like Little Red Riding Hood running through the woods to Grandmother's house. I was running in second gear and my legs were already burning. but I knew if I slowed down, they were going to catch me. I shifted to third gear and thought, goodness, I'd never run this fast. But the wolves were gaining on me, and I could almost smell them when the road turned from dirt to gravel. The wolves were getting even closer, so I switched it to fourth gear. Then the dirt road switched to pavement, and I figured I'd better run with whatever I had left in my tank. So I put the pedal to the metal and sprinted at full throttle. I put the hammer down and was running in fifth gear. After about half a mile, the wolves started losing ground, and then they lost interest in eating me altogether. If someone had timed me with a stopwatch, I would have set every world record from 40 yards to 10 miles. From a sprint to a marathon, I was moving, Jack. When I stopped running, I bent over and tried to catch my breath. My lungs were burning and my shirt was drenched in sweat. Good grief, it's hot, I thought. Then I smelled burning rubber. I figured some farmer was using tires to start a brush fire. But then I looked down, and the rubber soles of the tennis shoes I was wearing were on fire. They were ablaze in flames. Fortunately, it had rained the night before, so I stepped into a mud puddle and extinguished both of my shoes before my feet were badly burned. Hey, where there's smoke, there's fire, and I wasn't going to stick around just to be burned or eaten.
I sting like a butterfly and punch like a flea.
Chapter 9. Bumblebees. While I was growing up, my favorite thing to eat for breakfast during the winter was Mama's homemade buttermilk biscuits with honey. Boy, were they good. It's hard for me to get much sweeter, but I just love the pure taste of honey. Now my wife tells me all the time, I need honey, honey. Look. When you get honey in your beard, it literally stays there for 2 weeks. When my wife kisses me, she's like, ooh, that was good. She doesn't even know why. She just thinks I'm sweeter than most males. When I was 7, I was sitting on our front porch one day with Phil and Daddy. We looked over at Mrs. Wilson's house next door and saw a swarm of bees that had flocked on the purple jasmine over her back door. The swarm of bees was as big around as 2 basketballs. Hey, we're fixing to have us a beehive, Daddy said. He told Phil and me to get 2 chairs out of the kitchen while he went to get a hammer. We walked into the backyard where we had a 1-room shed. Daddy took the hammer and knocked a knot out of a pine board on one side of the shed. Then he took a saw and cut a board out of the shed. He cut 2 2x4s and nailed them to the inside of the shed, which is where the bees could build a honeycomb. He nailed a board back on the shed, which could easily be taken off and put back on to get access to the beehive whenever we wanted. Get one of those chairs and come with me, he told us. We walked over to the purple jasmine and put the chair in front of it. Daddy told me to stand on the chair. What do you mean, get on the chair? I asked him. Those bees are fixing to tear me up. Boy, get up here on a chair before I take off my belt and tear you up, he said. If you don't get up here, you're going to get torn up one way or the other. I figured the bee stings wouldn't hurt as bad as Daddy's belt, so I climbed on the chair. Daddy cut one end of the vine with his pocket knife and handed it to me. Be careful, he said. Don't be shaking the vine and moving it around or we will get stung. Daddy cut the other end of the vine and told Phil to take the chair back to the shed and put it next to the other one. Then we carefully carried the vine with the hive hanging from it to the chairs. We slowly set the vine on the chairs with thousands of bees swarming around it. I didn't even know bees liked jasmine. I thought their favorite flowers were begonias and honeysuckle. Hey, what do I know? Go get me another chair, Daddy said. I brought him another chair, and he sat down and waited. Finally, the queen bee rolled up to the top of the vine, and Daddy flicked her into the hole in the shed. Within a matter of seconds, every one of the other bees followed her into the hole. For the next 10 years, whenever we wanted honey, we went to the shed, pulled the 2 nails out, and robbed the honeycomb. One time, when it was time to ride the Beehive, Phil walked out wearing 2 pairs of blue jeans, 3 football jerseys, a pair of gloves, and a homemade screen wire helmet that went down to his shoulders. Phil was convinced he couldn't be stumped. We didn't trust him, so Mama, Tommy, and me sat in the kitchen watching him through the window. Phil took the nails out and pulled out the board, but didn't know there was a large honeycomb on the back of the board he had just pulled out. He threw it to the ground, and it landed face up. Within a matter of seconds, you couldn't see Phil's legs. They were covered in bees. He took off running, swatting the bees with every step. I don't know how many times he was stung, but it was a lot, Jack. Whenever we robbed the honey, we cut out the honeycomb, leaving just enough for the bees to survive. By the time we were done squeezing the honeycomb, we'd have about 3 gallons of honey, which lasted for nearly a year. It was another way we lived off the land. Phil wasn't the only one stung by bees. When Phil was in the 8th grade and I was in the 6th, we went squirrel hunting one day. As usual, Phil was walking in front of me and we were about to cross under a barbed wire fence. As Phil crawled under the fence, he grabbed a hold of a fence post which was rotted from the ground up. As soon as he grabbed the post, bumblebees started swarming out of it. Phil took off running, but I was already making my way under the barbed wire before I noticed them. I panicked and unknowingly ripped my blue jeans clean across my rear. I took off running behind Phil with the bumblebees chasing us. As I was running, I remembered something Mama told me. If bees are chasing you, you're supposed to fall down and lie still because they follow your vibration. So I fell down and played dead. Unfortunately, I didn't know my jeans were ripped. There was now a full moon in the middle of the day. I looked up and it was like World War II, with Allied fighter pilots bombing Germany. My white underwear was showing, and the leader of the bees said, "Boys, there's our target." They must have had advanced targeting systems because they didn't miss. Trust me, it didn't take them long to get me off the ground. I was running and crushing my underwear at the same time. When I got home, Mama said, "Well, drop your drawers." When I did, she busted out laughing. "Hey, it's not funny," I said. "If you could see it from my angle, it's funny," she said. "That's the biggest your butt has ever been." Mama sat in the kitchen and pulled 27 bee stingers out of my rear while she and Phil laughed. "Look, what's worse than being a fool? Fooling with a bee, Jack. Like the Beatles sang, let it be."
Jack, I can hurt you, physically and metaphysically.
Chapter 10, Kamikaze Pilot. When Phil left to play football with Tommy at Louisiana Tech University in Ruston in 1964, Jan and I were the only kids left in the house with Mama and Daddy. I was older than Jan, but I didn't pick on her because my older brothers picked on me so much. I didn't think it was the right thing to do because she was a girl. If she had been a boy, I'm sure things would have been much different. After Phil left for college, I still had to finish my junior and senior years at North Caddo High School in Vivian, Louisiana. I was a pretty good football player in high school, but there was this problem. I weighed 135 pounds when I was soaking wet. If I had weighed 160 or 180 pounds like Tommy and Phil, I would have gotten a scholarship to Louisiana Tech. There's no doubt in my mind. We grew up playing football in our backyard. We even had goalposts at one end, which Jimmy Frank and Harold made from a couple of oak tree uprights and a sweet gum crossbar. Our football field was about 30 yards long and half as wide. We played two hands below the waist touch football year-round. Jimmy Frank managed to bring home a few old footballs from his high school team, so we were always playing in the backyard. I played quarterback during my freshman and sophomore seasons at North Caddo High School and then moved to end on offense and cornerback and linebacker on defense. Tommy and Phil were really good football players. They played quarterback and halfback and were all district and all state players, so I had a pretty big legacy to live up to. I wasn't very big, but I was crazy enough and dumb enough not to know that the guy I was trying to tackle was twice as big as me. I didn't care how big he was. I was coming in there like a torpedo. I was a kamikaze pilot on the football field. I was the meanest and craziest 135-pound player on the field. Because my older brothers picked on me growing up, I didn't have a problem taking on guys who were bigger than me. I really enjoyed playing football and probably got the most from my God-given abilities. I played in a couple of games as a senior in 1965, but then I broke my arm in a car accident and missed the rest of the season. When the season was over, my coach called me into his office and told me he could get me a tryout as a walk-on player at Louisiana Tech. He told me if I was good enough to make the team and worked hard to get bigger and stronger, the Louisiana Tech coaches might even be willing to give me a scholarship a couple years down the road. My coach told me he thought I was talented enough to do it. When my coach was finished talking, I busted out laughing. "Hey, I've been in the Louisiana Tech locker room with Phil and all those boys," I told him. "Excuse me, I've been in the locker room with Phil and all those men. I weigh 135 pounds. I love the game, don't get me wrong, but I'm not stupid. I might not be the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I'm not the dullest one either. I love football, but I'm not getting on the field with those men." What I didn't tell my coach was that I wasn't even sure I wanted to go to college. I wasn't sure that 4 more years of school was the right thing for me. I'd had enough of going to class 5 days a week. Some parents get all bent out of shape because their kids don't want to go to college. Look, college isn't for everyone. I tried college 10 times and never liked it. To me, college is an endurance test. You put up with 4 or 5 years of crap just for someone to hand you a piece of paper that says you have some sense. Hey, newsflash for all you people. I got sense without the paper. And I didn't have to endure 4 or 5 years of crap for someone to tell me I'm smart. During the second half of my senior year of high school, we moved to Gonzales, Louisiana, because Daddy took a job there. I graduated from East Ascension High School in May 1966 with a bunch of strangers. It was terrible. Moving during my senior year really ruined my high school experience. I didn't get to graduate with the friends I grew up with, and we moved too late for me to make close friends with kids at my new school. Right after high school, I went to work for Daddy as a welder's apprentice on an oil rig. It was grueling work. I did okay on the smaller rigs, but once we were on the bigger rigs, it was too much for me physically. I wasn't as strong as Phil and Tommy and didn't have their stamina. It didn't take me long to figure out that the offshore drilling business wasn't for me. A couple of months after high school ended, Mama informed me I was going to college whether I wanted to go or not. While we never had much money, every one of my brothers and sisters graduated from college. Most of them even went back and received master's degrees. "No, I don't want to go to college," I told Mama. "I don't want you and Daddy wasting your money." "No, you're going to college," she said. "You don't have a choice." "What don't you understand?" I asked her. "I'm going to go to college and do nothing but party." Mama smiled at me and said, "Well, have a good one, because you're going to college." I asked Mama why she wanted to waste her money on sending me to school. "Because when you're out there digging ditches, I don't want you to say it was Mom and Dad's fault," she said. "We're giving you the opportunity to go to college." Like it or not, it was up to me to make the most of it.
I'm like an owl. I don't give a hoot.
Chapter 11. C is always the best answer. When I enrolled at Louisiana Tech in the fall of 1967, there were 4 Robertson brothers attending the same school. Tommy and Phil were playing on the football team, and Harold came there to get a master's degree after earning a bachelor's degree at Louisiana State University. It was like a family reunion. While my older brothers were at Louisiana Tech to actually get an education, I went there for 3 quarters and did nothing but party for 2 of them. Hey, I told Mama that's what I was going to do, and I'm a man of my word. I rarely went to class because I didn't have much interest in getting a college education. My partner in crime was Miss K's cousin, Charles Hollier. We called him Tinkerbell, and he was flunking out of school, too. We pretty much had our own fraternity. Kappa Tappa Kega. If I wasn't working at the mess hall or hunting and fishing with Phil and Tommy, I was drinking beer with Tinkerbell. He wasn't nearly as bad as I was about the party. It didn't take me long to figure out there was always a party somewhere at college if you looked for it, and I usually took the time to find one. Every weekend we had a get-together at either Tommy's house or Phil's. Both of them were married, so Miss Kay or Tommy's wife, Nancy, would cook us a big meal. They lived next to each other at the Vetville Apartments, which the school built in 1945 to accommodate married veterans coming home from World War II. The red brick apartments were located on South Campus, about a mile from the main campus. Phil's front yard was always littered with fishing boats, motors, duck decoys, and on occasion, animal carcasses. His neighbors loved him. During one gathering near the end of my third quarter at Louisiana Tech, Harold, Tommy, and Phil started getting on my case about not going to class. They were calling me stupid and lazy, and one of them said I wasn't smart enough to finish college. No, you're wrong there, I told them. Being intelligent has nothing to do with this. It's true that I was flunking out of school and I'd only been there for a few months. I was already on double secret probation with the dean as a freshman, and there wasn't much margin for error before I'd get thrown out of school. I really wasn't too worried about it. I made it to just enough classes so they couldn't kick me out of school for truancy, but I didn't expend much energy in studying for midterms and final exams. With only a week to go in my third quarter, Tinkerbell came to me and asked me if I knew anyone who would give us the lecture notes for our classes. If I flunk out, my daddy's going to kill me, Tinkerbell said. What do you think we can do about it now? I asked him. There's only a week until our finals, and we haven't been to class in a month. Hey, if you can get the notes, we'll hit the books, he said. So I found a couple of girls who gave me copies of their notes from our classes. Hey, have you ever known a woman who could tell me no? Over the next 4 days, Tinkerbell and I studied 74 hours in a row. We never went to sleep. We went to the store and bought 8 cases of soda pop. Look, I discovered that soda pop makes you drunk if you drink enough. This was back when they still used real sugar in sodas. We drank so many soda pops while studying that we were wired for 4 straight days. Hey, when we were done studying, I couldn't remember the last time I'd blinked. If someone had given me a cup of decaf coffee, I might have slipped into a coma. Thank goodness they hadn't invented Red Bull yet. The day of my final exams, I did fine in my first 3 classes. I breezed through the final exams and was as alert as a 1-legged man walking through a minefield in Vietnam. I was still wired from the caffeine. My last final exam was late in the afternoon, and it was one of my least favorite courses. Romance languages. Hey, what more could the professor have taught me that I didn't know already? Look, the final exam was about 100 questions. I answered about 15 of them, and the next thing I knew, the professor was shaking me. I fell asleep in the middle of the test. Wake up, he told me. You don't have but 10 minutes left to finish. There was one thing in my favor. The test was multiple choice. I didn't give a flip anyway, so I went through the answer sheet, filling in bubbles with my number 2 pencil all the way down. The test sheet looked like an etch-a-sketch when I was done. Fortunately, I remembered that C is always a good answer. It took me only 5 of the 10 minutes to complete the exam. I handed it to the professor and skipped out of the classroom. I figured I had probably taken my last college exam, so I gave Tommy $100 to buy us some steaks. Phil and Tommy were going to grill steaks for us the next day at an end-of-the-quarter party at Tommy's house. I had a job in college, so I usually had a few more bucks than my brothers. I worked in the freezer department of the university's cafeteria. The cooks prepared turkeys and then sent them down to us to wrap and freeze. When the cooks were ready to serve the turkeys to students, they thawed them out and warmed them up. One day, I went to work without eating lunch. Every time a turkey came down, I picked a little piece of meat off it. Hey, when you've picked 40 turkeys, you've had a full meal. At the end of the day, the foreman called us together. Hey, if you're hungry, take some time and go upstairs and eat, he said. Then he walked us into the freezer. There was a bare turkey carcass sitting there. It was so naked I wanted to find it some clothes. Its breasts were sticking out and its legs had been picked to the bone. I guess I was a little hungrier than I thought. Fortunately, the boss man didn't fire me. It was a good job and I always had a little money in my pockets when I was a student. When I arrived at Tommy's house the next day, Nancy wouldn't open the front door for me. She was looking through the peephole and then she started ranting and raving at me. The woman went slap insane. What is your problem? Nancy said. She worked in the registrar's office at Louisiana Tech, so I figured she'd seen my grades. I knew I'd be on the next bus back to Gonzales, Louisiana, when Mom and Daddy found out I'd flunked out. Are you going to let me in? I asked her. She stood behind the door and hollered at me for the next 5 minutes. Hey, look, if you don't open the door, I'm going to go back to the dorm, I said. She opened the door and screamed, No, you're not. Get in here and sit down. She pointed her finger at me and said, Did you go check your grades? No, I told her. I couldn't care less what my grades are because I'm not coming back. She proceeded to chew my butt out for the next hour. You really didn't go look at your grades, did you? She asked. No, I know I flunked out, I told her. I don't care what my grades are. I know one thing, college is not for me. By then, Tommy, Phil, and Harold were there, and they started in on me as well. They were calling me stupid and lazy again. Hey, y'all might as well get off of that, Nancy told him. What do you mean, Phil asked her. He parted for 6 months and never went to class and nearly made the dean's list, Nancy said. He was 3 points from making an A average. He's obviously not too dumb. Hey, I told you C is always the correct answer.
One time in Vietnam, I saw a grizzly bear riding a scooter.
Chapter 12. Big Oaf. Even though I earned my way onto the list of possible candidates for Louisiana Tech University's honors program, I didn't return to school for the next academic quarter in the spring of 1968. I knew going into my freshman year that college probably wasn't for me, but I gave it the old college try, and hey, I proved to my older brothers that maybe they weren't smarter than me. For whatever reason, I couldn't get into the routine of going to college. One of the things that really turned me off about higher education was that I met a lot of guys who had college degrees, and they told me they spent most of their time in classes like basket weaving and pottery. Then they'd tell me they majored in psychology. Hey, if you're going to become a psychologist, why are you learning how to make a basket in an ashtray? It doesn't make any sense to me. Some of the smartest people I know have sixth grade educations and started working in the seventh grade because their families needed them to work. Conversely, some of the most educated idiots I've ever met have a master's degree or PhD. They couldn't pour urine out of a boot with the instructions written on the heel. Breaking the news to Mama and Daddy wasn't easy. Even though I'd warned them about what was probably going to happen if they sent me to college, I knew they would be disappointed because each of my brothers and sisters was in school. They wanted me to have the same opportunity, and I'm sure they made some big sacrifices to make it happen. I think they might have even mortgaged the family farm to pay my tuition. I broke the news to Daddy when we were driving to a duck hole one morning during Christmas break. Daddy, I ain't going back to school, I told him. I know you and Mama really want me to go, but it ain't for me. Daddy looked at me and sadly shook his head. I could see the disappointment in his eyes. Si, after all the sacrifices your mother and I made over the last few months to come up with the money to send you to college, you still say ain't, he said. That was the end of our conversation. After 3 quarters of college, I decided it was time for me to major in psychology. I was ready to get on living my life and finding my place in the world. Of course, I knew Uncle Sam probably had other ideas for me. Phil, Tommy, and Nancy warned me that if I dropped out of college, I would probably get drafted into the military and be sent to Vietnam. American military advisors had been involved in the Vietnam War since 1950, and then our involvement escalated in the early 1960s. The number of American troops in Vietnam tripled in 1961 and tripled again in 1962, and then U.S. combat troops were first deployed there in 1965 to fight the Viet Cong and the spread of communism. After Congress passed the Military Selective Service Act of 1967, if you were a male, at least 18 years old, single, and not in college, you were going to Vietnam. Hey, I was 4 for 4, Jack. 2 weeks after I withdrew from Louisiana Tech, my draft papers arrived at my parents' house. I opened the letter and it basically said, "Uncle Sam wants you right now." A few weeks later, I reported to the Army Recruitment Office in Shreveport, Louisiana, where they gave me a physical and determined I was fit to serve my country. Was there ever any doubt? I went home to Dixie for about a month, and then I boarded a train in Shreveport in April 1968 for basic training at Fort Benning outside Columbus, Georgia. As soon as I stepped off the train, the drill sergeants were in my face screaming, "Get down, maggot!" My basic training lasted 8 weeks, and it was miserable. It was the start of a hot, sticky Georgia summer. Hey, it was so hot and humid that I saw trees fighting over dogs. That's how thirsty they were. Even the squirrels were using suntan lotion. Growing up in Louisiana, I was used to the heat and humidity, but it's a lot more unbearable when you're going through basic training. My basic training was especially hard because I had 2 drill sergeants with completely different personalities. The first one lasted only a couple of weeks and left because of a death in his family. I didn't even know the man, but it wasn't very long until I was missing him more than my mama. After he left, a bunch of us were sitting on the barrack steps waiting for the next guy who was going to make our lives miserable. We saw a taxicab coming down the main road in the base, and there was something wrong with it. Most automobiles are equally balanced on 4 tires, but this taxi was leaning heavily to the right side. It looked like the right side of the taxi was going to grind the asphalt on the road. When the taxi pulled up in front of our barrack, King Kong climbed out of the back seat. My new drill sergeant was about 6 feet 8 inches tall and weighed 450 pounds. He was wearing a Smokey the Bear hat that I could have taken a bath in. The guy was enormous. He was a huge man. His name was Sergeant Oliver, but we called him the Big Oaf behind his back. It seemed that his objective was to make my life as painful as possible. While the Big Oaf was determined to break me, I will give him credit for one thing. Fort Benning is an Army Ranger base. Look, you do not walk on a Ranger base, you run everywhere. We ran to the mess hall, showers, latrines, barracks, and everywhere else we went. We ran while brushing our teeth. You did not walk, you did the airborne shuffle, which is running. As large as the Big Oaf was, he actually ran right next to us everywhere we went. You had to respect the man for that. One day in basic training, the Big Oaf woke us at 5 a.m. and informed us we were going on a 10-mile run. We ate breakfast and then loaded our packs onto our backs. About an hour later, after most of us had puked up our breakfast, the Big Oaf yelled, "Man, you're doing a great job. We've already covered 5 miles. I guess we felt like the end was in sight because we picked up our pace. About an hour later, as we were really beginning to feel the weight of our packs, the Big Oaf yelled, "You're doing fine, men, just fine. We should reach the starting point any minute now." As much as he tried, I was never really intimidated by the Big Oaf. Since I was from a large family and had so many older brothers, people getting in my face and yelling at me never really bothered me. But some guys couldn't handle it, and their lives were miserable during basic training. I always thought the hazing was funny, but my drill sergeants never found it to be very humorous. They didn't like that I was laughing or smiling the entire time. Somehow, I made it out of basic training alive. On the day I graduated from basic training in June 1968, we were wearing our dress greens on the drill fields as we waited for the ceremony to start. The big oaf got in my face and was screaming at me again. It was almost as if he wanted one more shot at me. He started yelling, and of course, I busted out laughing. I couldn't help it. It made him so mad, he yelled his favorite words, "Drop, maggot!" I stood there and laughed at him. "Hey, I'm in my dress greens," I told him. "I'm not getting down and getting dirty. You're out of your mind." The big oaf looked at me in disbelief. "Am I hearing you say what I think you said, Private Robertson?" he asked. "Yeah, I ain't getting down and dirty," I told him. "Am I going to have to put you in the front leaning rest position, maggot?" he asked. "Are you serious?" I said. "Dead serious," he yelled. So I dropped and did 25 push-ups. I jumped up and was smiling again. "Wrong answer, maggot," the big oaf yelled. I dropped down and gave him 25 more. I was in the greatest shape of my life, so it wasn't a problem. But I was obviously still as stubborn as a mule. It took 300 push-ups before the big oaf finally wiped the smile off of my face. With my deployment to Vietnam right around the corner, I feared I wouldn't be smiling for much longer.
Your beard is so dumb, it takes 2 hours to watch 60 Minutes.
Chapter 13, Passing the Test. One of the main reasons I left college and went into the military was because I didn't want to have to attend class, and I really didn't like taking tests. What's the first thing the Army did with me once I graduated from basic training? Uncle Sam gave me a test. To assemble an effective fighting force, the United States Army believed it needed the right kind of man as well as the right kind of equipment in Vietnam. Hey, it didn't take the Army long to realize it had the right kind of man on its hands, but it had to figure out what kind of equipment to put in my hands to make me a killing machine. When I joined the Army, there were over 300 occupations available. The Army wanted to make sure it didn't waste my talents and abilities, so it gave me a long test to determine how I could help America the most. Fortunately for me, it was a multiple-choice test. Before the Army assigned me to a unit, I was required to take the Army Classification Battery, ACB, which graded incoming soldiers in areas such as electronics repair, general maintenance, mechanical maintenance, clerical skills, radio code, surveillance and communications, and, of course, combat. If a soldier scored well in electronics repair, he would probably be assigned to something like missile or air defense repair. If a soldier scored well in general maintenance, he might be assigned to areas like construction and utilities. Someone who scored well in combat might end up in the infantry or armor units, and high marks in clerical skills usually correlated well to desk jobs. Shortly after I was assigned to advanced infantry training at Fort Lee in Virginia in the fall of 1968, I took the ACB for the first time. Hey, I can recite the alphabet after drinking a 12-pack of soda pop while blindfolded and standing on one leg, so I knew the Army's test wouldn't be a problem. A few days after I completed the test, my commanding officer called me into his office. "Hey, Robertson, your smoke-blowing days are over," he told me. "What are you talking about?" I asked him. "The old country boy act you've got going isn't going to cut it anymore," he said. "You're in the top 5% in the world." "What world are you talking about?" I asked. "What don't you understand?" he said. "You just scored higher than 95% of the Army on the ACB. You're on the fast track." Now, you have to understand one thing. People were bombing the ACB worldwide in the Army in 1968. It was a big scandal throughout the military, and the Pentagon couldn't figure out if the test was flawed or if its troops really weren't that smart. A 70 was considered a passing score on the ACB. I scored a 69. Somehow, I was still better than nearly everybody else entering the Army at the time. When I saw my test results, I was surprised to see the areas in which I scored the highest. I scored extremely high in architecture and engineering, followed by clerical, mechanical maintenance, and surveillance and communications. As I sat there looking at my scores, I pondered what my vocation was going to be in the military. Would I be a spy? Hey, I'm kind of like Victoria. She has her secrets, and so do I. Need a secret, Santa? I'm your man. The Viet Cong would never detect me behind enemy lines. I'm the master of distractions. A couple of hand gestures, and bam! I'll pull the underwear clean off your butt. While espionage sounded enticing, so did the possibility of being a mechanic or engineer. My brothers and I were always building and fixing things when we were growing up. If our bicycles or boat motors broke, we had to fix them because we sure weren't getting new ones. We built forts, bridges, duck blinds, and dams when we were young. How much different could Vietnam really be from Louisiana? I even thought about going into the military police or becoming a cook. Hey, I'd rather eat my cooking than what I ate in Vietnam. I am the MacGyver of cooking. If you bring me a piece of bread, cabbage, coconut, mustard greens, pig's feet, pine cones, and a woodpecker, I'll make a great chicken pot pie. One time I cooked a big pot of soup. The label on the packaging said to empty the entire contents into the broth. Well, Miss K got a 20-cent coupon in her bowl of soup. At least she saved some money on her next trip to the grocery store. There were so many career choices in the Army, and it was difficult to pick only one. At first, the Army sent me to sniper school after I graduated from advanced infantry training. I guess they figured if I could shoot squirrels and ducks, I could hold my own on the battlefield and shoot Charlie. But I was only in sniper school for about a week. After a few days, I asked one of the instructors, "Hey, when are we going to shoot?" He told me we had 3 more weeks of classes before we would get our rifles. Well, you know how I am about attending classes. I told him. Send me to a unit. Now, just because the Army gives you a test doesn't necessarily mean it's going to put you in a job that best utilizes your skills. The Army tried to put people in areas where they could help it the most, but they weren't always good at doing it. If the Army had a truck driver and a computer engineer, you would think the former would drive a truck and the latter would work with computers. Not in the Army. No, let's switch it. The truck driver worked on computers, and the computer engineer drove the truck. The Army liked to break a man down and mold him into what it wanted. It didn't make any sense, but that's how they did it. I was assigned to be a Readiness Non-Commissioned Officer, NCO, in the areas of materials, supply, and accounting. My job was supervising supply requests, receipt, and storage, and maintaining an account of individual and organizational equipment. I was like the equipment manager of the Army. If a soldier wanted something in Vietnam, he had to come see me. Need a new pair of socks? I'm the man to see. Need ammunition for your M16? I'm the guy. Most days it was a pretty smooth process when soldiers came to see me. But if I was having a bad day, hey, all bets were off. Grab a Snickers bar, because you're not going anywhere for a while, Jack. I was also involved in the day-to-day operations of transporting soldiers, mobilization planning, maintenance, pay, and guard duty. I was basically the commander's right-hand man. I did whatever he told me to do. Now, I did not wear hard stripes. There were hard-striped soldiers in Vietnam, and there were specialists. A hard-striped soldier specialized in combat and war. A specialist was someone like the military police or a medic. We were specialists in something other than actual fighting. Everybody in the Army was trained to fight, but some of us were put in areas of support off the battlefield. After I graduated from advanced infantry training, they sent the notice of deployments to our barracks. Obviously, everyone was hoping to avoid Vietnam, but I always knew that was where I was going to be deployed. I didn't know why, but I knew in the bottom of my heart that's where I was going. Well, guys with last names that started with A to R were sent to Germany. Somehow, the list of last names beginning with R ended before Robertson. Then I and every guy with a last name after mine were sent to Vietnam. I was the only soldier from my company who was immediately deployed to Vietnam. Later, I found out the guys who went to Germany were only there for a couple of weeks of training and then were sent to Vietnam. A couple of weeks before I was scheduled to leave for Vietnam, a few of my buddies and I went to see a movie during a weekend pass. John Wayne had just finished making a war movie about Vietnam. It was called The Green Berets. It was about an army colonel who picked two teams of Green Berets to complete a dangerous mission in South Vietnam. We went to see the movie at a theater, and it scared every one of us. Even though the movie was fictional, the images looked real to me. It was the first time I'd seen war. I knew Vietnam was where I was fixing to go, and it didn't look like a very nice place. In fact, it scared me to death.
Hey, I gotta work with what I've got. It's called improvisation.
Chapter 14. Good Morning, Vietnam. My feet hit the ground in South Vietnam on October 19, 1968. Several guys told me their stories about flying into Vietnam, and a lot of them were pretty wild and scary. They told me about being bombarded with rockets and missiles as their jets landed. My arrival was pretty uneventful. We flew into the Con Ta airfield and climbed off the plane. It was eerily quiet until somebody said, "Welcome to Nam." Perhaps the thing I remember most about arriving in Vietnam is being overwhelmed by the smell of fish. Now, I grew up on the river, and my brothers and I were always fishing or cleaning fish, but this was different. I smelled fish everywhere I went. The South Vietnamese ate a lot of fish, and commercial fishing was one of their major sources of income. It wasn't necessarily a bad smell, but it was the only thing you could smell. Hey, how do you stop a fish from smelling? You cut off its nose, Jack. I was ready to cut my nose off after only a couple of weeks in Vietnam. When I returned home after my 12-month enlistment, I couldn't stand the smell of fish. I couldn't even stomach the smell when I went to Phil's house on the Ouachita River years later. It's one of the reasons Phil gave up fishing altogether after he quit working as a commercial fisherman. Phil was around fish so much as a commercial fisherman that he didn't want to be near them after he quit. I'm the same way when it comes to fish, even more than 40 years after I left Vietnam. Con Ta is the largest city in the Mekong Delta and is about 75 miles southwest of Ho Chi Minh City, which was called Saigon when I was in Vietnam. It sits near the Mekong River and is the Delta's commercial hub. Today, Con Ta produces about half the country's rice. Rice paddies, low-lying marshes, and mangrove swamps surround the city, as does a vast system of natural and man-made canals. There were floating markets where you could buy fish, fruits, and vegetables. I'm sure it's a beautiful city now, but it wasn't very picturesque when I was there, at least not to me. While I was deployed to Vietnam, I lived in a 3-story hotel in downtown Con Ta. The army base in Con Ta wasn't big enough to have barracks to house all the troops, so a bunch of soldiers stayed in hotels with names like the Pink Palace, Cheap Charlie's, and the Mekong Hotel. From what I remember, the hotel I stayed in was far from a palace, and I'm sure the rent was pretty cheap for Uncle Sam. Fortunately for me, I arrived in Con Ta about 9 months after the Tet Offensive. On January 31, 1968, the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese launched a series of surprise attacks against South Vietnam, American forces, and our allies during what was supposed to be a 2-day ceasefire during the Tet Lunar New Year celebration. More than 70,000 North Vietnamese and Viet Cong troops attacked more than 100 cities and towns in South Vietnam, including the Con Tah airfield, which is where I primarily worked. It took American forces about 3 days to clear Con Tah of Viet Cong troops. Although U.S. and South Vietnamese forces fought back most of the attacks, the Tet Offensive was a major turning point in the Vietnam War. The North Vietnamese and Viet Cong put the U.S. on notice that they were more organized and stronger than we suspected. In a civil war, like what was happening in Vietnam, it's hard to figure out who's fighting for what side. What most people don't understand about the military is that if you go to a foreign country, sometimes they don't speak your language and don't want you there. In other words, most of the people there don't like you. Hey, I wasn't trying to make friends in Vietnam. My only goal was to complete my 12 months and get back to Louisiana as quickly as possible. Although I was there for only 1 year, it was a really difficult time in my life. It was the first time I'd been away from my parents, brothers, and sisters, and I was thousands of miles across the Pacific Ocean from home. I wasn't quite sure why we were fighting in a land so far from home, but I was bound and determined not to get myself killed while I was there. One of the things I remember most about being in Vietnam is watching movies on the roof of the hotel where I was living. We had a movie projector set up, and we sat and watched movies nearly every night. When I first got to Vietnam, I sat on the roof and watched guys going out. They'd leave sober, but then they'd come staggering back.